TED Audio Collective.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
This is Design Matters with Debbie Millman from DesignObserver.com. On this program, Debbie Millman talks with Public Radio's John Hockenberry about designing his morning news show, The Takeaway, about journalism in the era of Facebook and Twitter, and about the unfriendly way he learned he was about to have his fifth child.
And I hear this scream from the living room. Get in here! And I looked at this little pregnancy test thing, and it said pregnant on it in the nastiest font.
Here's Debbie Millman.
If you listen to public radio, odds are you know this voice.
Good old French President Nicolas Sarkozy. Not terribly popular these days, but quite the entertainer.
It's, of course, John Hockenberry, host of the morning show The Takeaway. You might also remember seeing him when he was a reporter for ABC and NBC. And if you've been around for a while, you'll remember his reporting for NPR from the first Gulf War, wheelchair and all. But did you also know that he wrote and appeared in his own off-Broadway play? That in his spare time he's written a novel and a memoir? That in 2007 he was named a distinguished fellow at the MIT Media Lab? That he has two sets of twins, plus a fifth child? John Hockenberry joins me at the Masters in Branding Studio at the School of Visual Arts in New York City to talk about the twists and turns of his hard-charging career. John, welcome to Design Matters.
Hey there. I'm exhausted listening to that now. Oh, my goodness. I could not possibly have done all that.
Yes, you did.
Yes. And thank you for reminding
me. And you're not even that old.
Between you and me, girl. There we go. Anyway, thanks. It's great to be here. I think this is a terrific conversation about issues that mean a lot to me. As you know, I go way back in the design world, even though I'm just a boring old journalist from the design perspective. And, it's been funny because Steelcase is celebrating its 100th anniversary next year. And my dad was the first director of design at Steelcase.
That I did not know.
And I've had some interaction as the company sort of figures out where it's going next and imagining just the beginnings of Steelcase's design world when I was just a teenager and my dad, having his struggles with engineering and all that sort of thing. And when Steelcase turned from just designing desks and objects to be really much more of a philosopher king in terms of the design world, or trying to be, as many institutions are, but Steelcase has done pretty well.
Well, haven't they bought IDEO? Don't they own IDEO?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know.
And that's a real under-the-radar kind of story.
You know, you'd have to ask Steelcase about that. My sense is that they don't want to be perceived as just some sort of, behemoth gobbling up stuff. But I think they definitely want to maintain a territory and a beachhead in the design world. I'm an outsider these days, but that's my impression.
Well, I want to come back to talking about design in a little while, but the first thing I want to ask you about is a tweet that you tweeted on Wednesday. You wrote, "Everything I know about radio comes from Norman Corwin," after you heard that Corwin had died. You were, of course, referring to Norman Corwin, a man who wrote, produced, and directed scores of award-winning radio dramas for CBS in the 1930s and 40s and came to be known as the poet laureate of radio. He died on October 18th at 101 years old. Why did you tweet that? What were some of the things that, the most important things you learned?
You've described Corwin accurately, but in a sense, unless you know his work, you don't really understand what a huge revolutionary he was. I mean, we think of this discourse of public radio, this kind of talking to one person, even though you're in a giant sort of radio domain where you could be talking to millions of people. And it's not the commercial realm where it's, "Hi, Debbie, how you doing? Here we are talking about design."
Talk about that in a little while.
Where you're kind of – you got this sort of megaphone psycho personality, which is what commercial radio is all about. The discourse of public radio, that kind of intimacy and storytelling quality that merges with journalism, came directly from Corwin. It came from one person. One person who understood radio but was trained as a newspaper guy. The qualities of sort of putting together a radio theater of the mind and leaping from both history to fiction and fact and journalism and essay and editorial, merging all of that together with the most whimsical of sound effects and things. It became the basis for Rod Serling's work, as well as Edward R. Murrow's work, as well as people like Andy Rooney. You know, they're tiny little sort of pieces of the Corwin legend. One of his broadcasts, and I can't remember the name right now or I'll botch it, at the end of World War II, answered the question, "What have we won here?" right after the victory over Germany.
I actually have a quote that I want to read you.
Yeah, it is considered
from that
to be
broadcast,
the finest radio broadcast ever. And I don't think anything from then or before can touch it.
And I want to ask you about that. So this is what he said. "We've beaten this monster, Hitler. The war goes on, but what are the questions? And the questions were, who have we beaten? What did it cost to beat him? Have we learned anything out of this war? And is it going to happen again?"
And of course, that was at a moment when the Pacific War was still going on. We hadn't dropped the bomb at Hiroshima and Nagasaki yet. The idea that someone would step out at a moment like that when America's triumphalism was supreme and it would take that one additional step with the dropping of the atom bomb. And at that point, the Cold War had begun. And here is someone with the courage to essentially question a victory on the eve of McCarthyism. He had the absolute courage to question that. And, you know, think about what happened after the invasion of Iraq, where the entire media went lock, stock and barrel into the tank with the Bush administration. And it wasn't until not only Abu Ghraib, but it was patently obvious that the mission, the pretext and, of course, the execution. And I mean, you know, quite literally the execution of the war and the treatment of Iraqi civilians afterwards was monstrous and dishonest in every way. It was only then that the media even began the process of, well, what have we done here? Corwin did it at the moment of clear victory and anticipated all of the ambiguities and ambivalent consequences of World War II that we're still living today.
A few hours later, you also tweeted, "A memorial service for Steve Jobs on the same day Norman Corwin passes, two icons that changed and then defined the way we tell stories." So I have two questions for
you about that tweet.
First is, how do you think that Steve Jobs changed and then defined the way we tell stories?
Pixar. Look at Pixar. I mean, seriously, Jobs is coming from a different direction. You know, Corwin kind of comes out of the journalistic tradition. Jobs comes out of an engineering, sort of liberal artsy geek tradition. I mean, he went to Reed College. This is not MIT. Reed College, okay? And both Corwin and Jobs, and the comparison is fragile, so I won't belabor it, but I think it is fair to say that Jobs and Corwin didn't particularly care about the categories of technology. They didn't think that a box did one thing and not another. They thought very, very broadly about what it meant to be able to broadcast your voice to millions of people, in the case of Corwin, and to connect people in the way that you could connect them digitally and in the things that you could do with digital media that went way, way beyond the computery, screeny kinds of things that I think are characteristic of IBM, Microsoft to a certain extent. I mean, I think when Steve Jobs left Apple originally, they were making boxes, and they weren't great boxes. And Jobs, aside from being pushed out of the company for one reason or another, wanted to explore way more of the implications of what was possible in this box. And so he created Next, and Next created enabling technology for Pixar, for animation. And I think you see with Pixar the development of a Hollywood style of high-tech storytelling. But you also see with the creation of tools like Final Cut and iMovie and GarageBand, kinds of things that people are able to create their own stories. And that, you know, was helped along by the developments of video technology that Steve Jobs didn't have much to do with. But I think he understood as those tools were coming down the pike, this is where he wanted to land, in a place where people have these agnostic notions of technology, and they just sort of have a camera and they have a microphone and they
become
have
a journalist
and they,
of and sorts.
They, exactly. Yeah. And we are all, you know, archiving, curating, and advancing our own stories with this media. And Corwin and Jobs are sort of two ends of that continuum.
That access that people have to reporting, the iReporting, so to speak,
right.
How do you think that that's changing the way that journalists, professional journalists, are reporting?
Well, I think journalists play a character, and it's called the journalist character. Whereas, you know, iReporter sounds great in journalism school seminars about what is the future of media. But I don't think people don't suddenly say, hey, I'm an iReporter. People just, I want that picture. That's really interesting. You got to hear this. Look at what I saw today. These are the much more visceral, basic questions that constitute the reporting at that level. And you're seeing stories told in low resolution, in a kind of conversational, hey, check it out style. Texting is a form of headlining, which has none of the conventions of journalism, but every bit of the urgency. So I think it's creating more of a caricature for journalists. Journalists seem more like kind of strange, archaic folks, not in the technology they use, but just in the way they speak. This sort of formalism of journalism, I think, is a problem. And journalists have to justify that. They can't just show up and go, now I'm here, we'll get it right. CBS News or, you know, whatever, ABC News or NPR, whatever. It doesn't work that way. People don't necessarily believe that that's the case. And I think the whole discourse of how journalistic stories are told is under sort of profound change. I don't think it changes anything that journalists do unless they're unwilling to experiment with the style of discourse, because they're going to look ridiculous and obsolete if they don't. Now, that doesn't change the thresholds of quality and truth that go along with authoritative journalism. But as we've also seen in this media time, how you acquire authority online, you know, in this sort of broad multi-platform world of media, journalism is one way. Traditional sort of New York Times style, two source verification and corroboration is one way, but there are other ways. There are other ways to have that authority. And when you get that authority, then you get the audience. When you get the audience, then you have the influence. And then you begin to drive things like political campaigns or corporate brands or, you know, celebrity brands. It's that authority that produces the audience. And then the audience produces the influence. And I think
then that influence and the audience and influence produces revenue.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, either revenue or change. I mean, some people aren't interested in producing revenue necessarily, but they are interested in getting a viral message out that is important for, you know, breast cancer survivors, or is important to the administration, or is important to a challenger to the administration, that sort of thing.
Well, I also wonder about the viability of being a journalist in the future when there is so much access and so much free content. Where is the line going to be drawn between the people that are paid to provide better content, more insightful content, more legitimate content, if that is something that can be assured in a day and age where so much is just free. I know many, many journalists that question whether or not their futures are intact, not because of the platforms, but because of their ability to provide livings for their families.
Well, I think, you know, and I'm under as much pressure on this as anyone, and, you know, had the poor timing of having five, you know, kids.
We're going to get to that,
too. At this particular stage of my life. But I actually don't think that the criteria for the viability of journalism is whether individuals who in the 1980s and 90s made a great living at it can still do so.
Oh, I don't know about great living, John. I'm talking about any living.
I mean, the
New York Times reporters, the Boston Globe reporters took decreases in salary.
You can look at the music business and they're going through the same thing. You can look at the graphic arts business and they're going through the same thing. I mean, I think the record industry is a pretty interesting case in point because for most of human history, music was an experiential product. Literature was that way until the printing press. I mean, Homer, you know, was like a concert video wandering around
right.
Greece telling this story over and over again. Exactly.
Yes.
So I think when
one-man show.
Exactly. When music became an object that you buy and sell in the form of a record, vinyl record, or a CD, it completely changed history, And I think all media went through this period of, all right, well, then I want one of those. I want an object I can sell or a particular brand that I can sell, design a vertically integrated business model around where the distribution channel is limited because I have a certain amount of power, whether you're a record company or a network. It's control of the distribution channel that gives you this objectified notion of journalism comes down this channel and the other channels we don't care about, but we sell this channel and we get money and then we pay the journalists, you know, and the publishers, let's be real. That's changing. I mean, I think the distribution channel is changing. The technology goes directly to the distribution channel issue. And if that's going to fall apart, no amount of hand-wringing and bemoaning is going to change that. And I think the sooner journalists embrace that the distribution channels are changing and that there's going to have to be some other sort of model, and that's not to say we should work for free, you know, the sooner we're going to get the other side. I mean, you're already seeing stabilization in certain kinds of media where the distribution channel is becoming much more horizontal and it's acquiring a horizontal sort of distribution channel rather than a narrow vertical one that is going to be where the business model lands. But I mean, while I think all journalists need to think like publishers a little bit more in this era, I don't confuse my job with the job of Rupert Murdoch. I don't want to. But if I think personally more like a publisher about the content that I produce and less like a minion sort of getting assignments or submitting my stuff to some behemoth called the New York Times or NBC News or even National Public Radio for that matter, the better I'm going to be. But, you know, we're all in this salary cap era, whether you're working for the NBA or journalists nowadays. And I think journalists make a mistake of, I think, spending a lot of time bemoaning this.
Oh, so do designers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it's a serious issue.
Yeah.
Believe me, my wife and I talk about it all the time. But I think it's wrong to conflate that anxiety with where journalism is going. Because music's doing fine without the record companies. It's doing just fine. Now, we can complain about how much money we have and have a few beers about that. But I don't think music is having a problem. And I don't think journalism is going to have a problem either.
Tell me about your relationship with Twitter. Why are you tweeting? What do you think about that whole way of communicating?
You know, I saw like an original, it wasn't even a beta. It was probably a pre-beta of Twitter when I was up at the Media Lab. You know, I was Media Lab in 2004 and 2005, and I saw Facebook in very early inclinations and just got nuts over Facebook and got in all kinds of trouble. I mean, just all kinds of flirty relationship kinds of, oh, let's spend time on Facebook with, you know,
I
was a gigantic
details.
Mess. No, there will be no more details. But I was very early on in the experience of what Facebook could do and what Twitter could do. And what I discovered is that Facebook could be a total addiction, an immersive kind of addiction that would allow you to experience multiple identities and to live in worlds where you could pretend to be someone. Not that you explicitly weren't, but behave in a way that you would never behave in person. And that was what was fascinating to me about Facebook. It turned out to be just not something that a public figure should ever get involved in. And I think, you know, when not that I experienced these same kinds of things, but I think the trouble that some public figures have gotten into in their just outrageous interactions in public space under the delusion that they were somehow having a private conversation, that was an implication of the technology that I saw very early on at the Media Lab and experienced personally. And, you know, it didn't take very long for me to go, you know, this is not a great thing for me. Facebook works, you know, in this particular useful zone for me, but probably nowhere else. And I don't spend a lot of time on Facebook after having that initial experience years and years ago. I think the growth of Facebook, I think, relates to this addictive quality of being in an immersive world. Now, to Twitter, your original question, it's the opposite. It's completely the opposite. It's this kind of sending smoke signals idea. It's not immersive. It's like we're ships on the ocean and we get to go honk, 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 honk. You know, and I love that quality. And there's an interesting journalistic quality in Twitter because it's all headline. In many ways, Twitter says, in ways that the New York Times does not say, the New York Times says, here's a complete picture. You've got the New York Times today. This is all you need to know. This is the world. Of course, that's wrong. It's a delusion. Twitter says, pay attention, assemble the data points in this mosaic we call what's happening today, and see if the picture resolves for you. So it encourages and invites the tweet receiver to put together a picture of what's going on, which is exactly what editors do, you know, in the broadcast center at CBS, for instance, when all hell is breaking loose and there's a million pictures coming in and you're seeing it on 50 different screens and you have to resolve in an almost instantaneous real-time context what's happening. What is happening here? People are doing that with media like Twitter, and I think that's very, very exciting, and I like it.
So you said that you were being tame and timid in relation to other people that might be putting up different, much more lurid things on Facebook. But there is some rather untame, untimid information that you've put online about your sex life, and I want to talk to you about sex.
Okay. You're referring to this New York Times project that
the video short in. For yeah. The New York Times, right. Where you are referred to as John, comma, 50, comma, boomer. And this is one of the quotes of some of what you said. You said, when you realized that you were no longer in service to Mr. Penis, wow, a whole new world opens up. So talk about why you were so willing to talk so openly and revealingly about your sex life.
Well, let's just say that I don't typically talk about Mr. Penis, except in this particular case, what they were interested in was how my sexuality has changed from the fact that I have a spinal cord injury. You know, I don't have any sensation lower than the mid-chest, basically where the nipples are. So, you know, that you have that experience at age 19 – you know, and you have absolutely no tactile sense of anything going on below your mid-chest, that, you know, has a kind of redefining impact on your sex life, particularly a teenager, you know,
right.
who's sort of ready to rock and roll at any point, you know, 19 in the 70s, you know, let's, you know, go to Planet Sex every night if we could, you know, kind of thing. So as a result, you know, you retain your sexual identity because much of what happens sexually is in the mind. And because when you say sex is in the mind, you're essentially talking about a sort of mind-body relationship, not unlike a, you know, human-machine interface kind of question where the mind creates a projection of an external object. In this particular case, a pretty intimate external object, external to the mind, which happens to be, you know, your, you know, tactile sexual equipment, you know, your sex organs, whatever it is, male or female. And so when you lose this sense of physical tactile reality, all of a sudden, you know, you're not being driven by a set of nerve impulses out there on the body that need to be triggered or pushed.
Satisfied or
whatever. Yeah. I mean, there's a kind of a neuronal narrative to sex that relates specifically to this idea of, you know, being in the service of Mr. Penis. And it's just like certain stuff has to happen And when men and women get together in sort of traditional ways, the idea is, all right, whatever we're doing here and however much I love you and however much I want to learn more about you or whatever, like, certain things are going to happen here, right? And that is all dictated by this sense of the tactile qualities of the body associated with sex.
Well, it's interesting because I think human beings do use sex as a way to connect emotionally in the mind. So we're using this sort of bodily expression of trying to be one with each other.
Well, I think on a good day, yeah. I mean, I think in many ways, it becomes, you know, let's get the body stuff out of the way and we'll see how the emotion stuff sort of lands. You know, which is what creates the awkwardness in the morning or, you know, got to go now or what do we say now kind of thing. At the end, I think the extent to which people are disconnected from their bodies and their emotional qualities are in opposition to the physical qualities or are a vacation from the complicated emotional qualities. I mean, that's what this sort of – in our era, this commitment phobia thing is about. It's men using – sex and physical intimacy as a kind of escape from the complexities of emotional connections. And even though bodies and minds are predisposed to having this all integrated, we unlearn that, I think, in the course of modern post-industrial American life. And we become this sort of can the body fix the mind? Can the mind control the body kind of thing? And sex becomes this questionably valuable experience where, you know, you have movies that everything will be great until we have sex kind of thing, these sort of trivializations of a much deeper problem. In my case and in this New York Times piece, the idea wasn't to just be needlessly candid about my physical situation, but it was to convey an insight that once you were free of that, once you had to find another way to create physical intimacy, both in terms of satisfying somebody else and having something satisfying for yourself, you were forced to rely much more on the emotional qualities, the mental qualities. You had to find different projections. You couldn't come up with equivalencies. You couldn't just, you know, go buy some plastic object and pretend that was, you know, Mr. Penis or something like that. You had to do something much deeper and much more profound. And that, you know, goes along with a whole variety of redefinitions that happen when you have an injury like a spinal cord injury. You know, you don't walk anymore. So how you get around, you have to redefine that. You redefine a whole lot of things. But in sexual terms, the process of redefinition can be very joyful and liberating. And that's, I think, what I was referring to there. I was happy not to have to service this kind of, you know, 5 to 7 minute arc of, you know, biology in the course of you know, my sexuality. I was freed of that. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't miss it, you know, but it was liberating if you could approach it in a way that, you know, allowed you to find a new way. And I think that's what they were interested in. They certainly weren't interested in my biceps and what I look like in a Speedo, you know, in that piece. Although it was very well shot,
and it's actually rather short. It's only, I believe, a minute and 49 seconds.
And they had a whole bunch of other people talking too.
And yet it was incredibly powerful. I came away from that minute 49 thinking quite a lot about what we tell ourselves about intimacy, and then also profoundly moved by your saying that after having some additional technological advancements, that after 4 kids, after 11 years of marriage, for the first time in not only my married life but in my post-accident sex life, you have an orgasm inside of your wife's body. I mean, that's not something that you forget.
And not only do you not forget it, but, you know, when I went to my urologist and said, so when we use this stuff, dude, you know, Dr. Rakhama, you know, do I need to, like, you know, be thinking about, you know, stuff I haven't thought about since I was 19. And he says, no, John, I'm looking at your chart and I think you are a form of birth control. So don't worry about it at all. And so after one particular weekend 4 weeks later, my wife was experiencing symptoms that were a little unusual and we couldn't figure out what was going on. And we certainly reverted back to like 15-year-olds. We were going, oh, my God, when was the last time? Let's look at the calendar. Oh, my God, are you late? You are late. What is – your breasts are a little big. And we're having this conversation. Could you be? No. And we have, you know, 4 kids running around. And I said to my wife, You know, I think you can go down to the drugstore and they have these like tests that you can buy. You know, this is how clueless we were. You know, our whole experience was with in vitro.
Well, you have two sets of twins. Yes.
So the idea of natural fertilization was just so completely counterintuitive
and so cheap.
Yeah, exactly. So she goes down to the drugstore. She comes back, and I was out in the kitchen with the other kids, and I hear this scream from the living room, "Get in here!" And I go in, and I looked at this little pregnancy test thing, and it said pregnant on it in the nastiest font. I mean, I'm telling you, women that get that and they have to see that, it's just sort of like pregnant there. It's one, I don't even know what you call that font. It's just sort of like, dummy, you know.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because there are two groups of people that are looking at it thinking, exactly, hopefully not. And then a whole group that are going, please.
Well, there's probably the group that's going, please, is probably almost identical, even though they're in different age groups.
Right.
The people who are going, no, are very different groups. There, you've got the you've got the teenager, no. You've got the, oh my God, this is the last thing I need right now, sort of, you know, middle-aged or heading into middle age, which is what my wife was. And in our case, it was both, oh, this is the last thing we need, and yet it was completely joyful.
I can only imagine.
Completely miraculous. I mean, this is a total miracle baby kind of thing. And Ajax was born on December 4th, almost exactly 2 years ago.
Why Ajax? And what's?
If you have two sets of twins and you go in for number five and he's a miracle baby, we're not doing Joe, okay? We're not doing Fred or Cindy.
Yeah, but all your children have really unusual and beautiful names.
No, Zoe, Olivia, Zachary, Regan. It had to be bigger.
Okay.
I'll tell you the names. Tycho was a possibility.
Tycho.
Tycho Brahe, you know, the astronomer. Tycho was a possibility. Ptolemy was a possibility.
Nice. PT, right?
Yep, there you go. And Allison and I just loved Ajax. I think it just was perfect.
So you have five children, two sets of twins, and now a two-year-old. When do you find time to write and work and do everything else that you do now? How is that even possible?
Well, I mean, I think that is not so much of an issue. I mean, the fact that I do a morning radio show where I get up at 2 in the morning, that's the killer. I mean, Monday through Friday, I'm up at 2 in the morning. I go.
What time do you go to bed?
8:30. So, my wife and I are barely in a room when I'm not either asleep or she's not asleep, a room alone. And so that's tough. I think the five kids, though, on the weekends, I have plenty of time to write. I got a book proposal going right now. I'm working on a bunch of projects outside of the family, doing a lot of music, a lot of playing music. And, you know, it's fun playing music with the kids now. We got these, like, various little impromptu bands. We got sort of a bluegrassy band. We got a rock band with, like, you know, three of the kids and me. We've got a sort of a show tunes thing going with my 10-year-old daughter and me on the piano. And so that's all fun. There's certain logistics about, you know, shuttling people around that can be frustrating with five kids. But I think I'm much more concerned about what the hell am I going to do when they're gone? Oh, my God. It's going to be long stretches of the day. How will I fill that time? I mean, you know, we're talking some serious books. I mean, you know, I'll be writing some encyclopedias probably in about 5 years.
Well, in 2008, you started The Takeaway. You were working on it for the year before. It really marked your return in many ways to your roots in radio.
Yeah.
You worked in television for quite a long time. Why go back to radio?
I worked in radio for 12 years, then in television for 12 years. And, you know, I think the radio project sort of presented itself to me. I was at that point putting together a kind of a patchwork quilt of various freelance kinds of things and was pretty satisfied with that. And WNYC and PRI came to me in 2007. And the campaign was starting up and was certainly going to be a very interesting story. We had no idea how significant the economy was going to be as a daily crisis story. But the prospect of doing live what NPR and public radio in general has done very effectively as essentially a taped magazine format, a very high fidelity quality. If you're talking about like Radiolab and This American Life, it's extremely high fidelity, high production value, but not live. There's nothing live about it. And I think in general, public radio is not live. And so the prospect of inventing a kind of live theatrical but yet journalistically valid format for delivering news and information much more nimbly than public radio has traditionally been able to do it was a very interesting design question, a design program. Because you couldn't do Firesign Theater. You know, that wasn't going to work. You couldn't do, Stern, Shock Jock.
Right.
Even though the qualities of liveness there are what makes that electrifying. I mean, I think that's, if you're not totally offended by Howard, and I mean, Howard's personality just gets a little old after a while and some people tune out. But in general, as a platform for generating information, those sorts of surprising, candid conversations are pretty great. But it's not a model for public radio. It's not going to work. So you really have to start from the beginning. I mean, what works? What and you can't just do like graduate seminar panel discussions, on the NewsHour on PBS. I mean, that's fine for Jim Lehrer, but that's not going to work in morning drive time on the radio. Nobody wants to listen to that. So it's got to be engaging. It's got to be very smart. It's got to be very surprising, and it's got to deliver information. People can't feel as though they're hearing some indulgent conversation but missing what's actually going on in the world. So those are pretty important, intriguing kinds of design questions. And Takeaway is still a work in progress, but it's been pretty interesting trying to go for that territory.
You've been very critical about the state of television. Back in 2008, you wrote in the MIT Technology Review an article called "You Don't Understand Our Audience." And you said that what you'd learned about network television in the years since your departure, you have acquired a certain detachment about how an institution so central to American culture could shift so quickly to the margins. And then you further went on and said that television news has lost its most basic journalistic instincts in its search for the audience-driven sweet spot. And then further went on and said, this explains why all anchors seem to sound alike, why reporters in the field all use the identical tone of urgency, no matter whether the story is about the devastating aftermath of an earthquake or somebody's lost kitty.
I think, television's business model, as successful as it has been, it creates a kind of uniformity and conformity that is inescapable. And that's not to say that there aren't incredibly skilled and courageous journalists working in television. And most of them are. I think the institutional frame in television journalism is a very difficult frame within which you can have a diversity of discourse. I mean, I think take, for instance, the various networks. NBC, and I worked there for a long time, I think was constrained, not so much anymore because it's changing at all the networks right now. All three of them have had serious management shakeups. I think Fox has had and CNN have also had very difficult, challenging, transformative kinds of shifts going on right now. So, in 2008, and that was a story about really the 2003 to 2006-07 period.
Oh, I think it's only gotten worse now, actually.
No, I actually think it's gotten better.
You
may notice on television, examples of things which make you more exasperated. But I think, the traditional news orientation in television is suddenly the innovative form. It's kind of gone full circle. It's been out of favor for so long that you actually see it coming back in places like CBS. NBC is about to launch a new news magazine, which will not resemble Dateline at all. And not to say there's anything wrong with Dateline anymore. Dateline has found its place in the world, and that is totally fine. And 48 Hours Investigations on CBS has also found its place and serves an audience. 60 Minutes, though, is as strong as ever. The fact that the lead correspondent on 60 Minutes is now the anchor at the CBS Evening News is an important signal that the news ethos at least one of the networks is as strong as it's ever been. The business model stuff is all up in the air, but I actually think that we've come around a corner and there are some interesting possibilities moving forward. There is a sense of getting back to a news ethos and using that online. I mean, I think some of the online successes that the networks have all been in the news realm, the traditional news realm, with certain exceptions. When Charlie Sheen gets on video or something like that, that's the kind of thing that goes really viral and
And but again, you know, part of the responsibility of the networks, be they television or be they the Huffington Post, is to monitor the conversation that's going on in the culture.
I mean, I think the big issue that I have is more about the segmenting of camps. So, and I'm probably talking more about cable news than I am about network news.
Yeah, and cable news is a whole other thing.
Yeah.
I wouldn't conflate cable news with news. Cable news is sort of a metastasized editorial page phenomenon.
And I feel like you can't learn anything anymore when you watch that, when you watch either side, because it's just playing to a certain camp that isn't going to change their mind to begin with.
You know, I'm frustrated about that myself. And I think, you know, we'll have to see what happens with Current TV and Olbermann and Al Gore and Joel Hyatt's experiment online. And I think the fact that, you know, everything's going to live in the cloud in the next 5 years and that you'll be able to stream any kind of program that you want that you can create on your own. So the live cable element is maybe going to diminish a little bit. But I do think that for those of us who grew up in the FCC era, where the idea was that if you had a broadcast license, that granted you a certain kind of authority, as opposed to what the cable news operation is, it's much more a throwback to the Hearst era of the very early 20th century, which is unfamiliar to us. We know about this sort of authoritative objectivity approach to broadcasting. And so television is, you know, the way that you experience it at Fox or CNN or, you know, even Rachel Maddow is just it's off-puttingly point of view. Kids, though, now, you know, people in their 20s, 18, 19, 20 now, they expect a certain kind of point of view. And it doesn't even have to be a factual point of view. Colbert is a legitimate lens for viewing newsmakers.
Yes.
And kids have no issue with that. Absolutely no
issue
with that.
Well, they have no issue that he's playing a character.
No. And in fact, the character is a useful filter. It is a useful sort of filtering mechanism that Stephen, as a performer, and I know Stephen, he understands very, very well that not only is it useful to have that lens so that you can see how well, you know, Barack Obama does in front of that lens versus an educational pointy-headed academic like Leon Botstein from Bard does, or how Judy Woodruff does, or how Michelle Obama does. And if you have it all through that same lens, you get a sort of objective sense of where the truth lies. That lens is useful, and it's equivalent to the New York Times lens and to the CBS News lens. Kids don't particularly need the lens to be the best lens. It's just a lens, and I'll evaluate it on my own. And I think people come to cable news with that idea. And Comedy Central is cable news. Stewart and Colbert are cable news. And Stephen understands that this is again, it gets back to the Corman thing. This is a merger of the theatricality of storytelling, the urgency of history, and the truth-telling that is what news is supposed to be. You can get all that mixed up in the most toxic of brews, but when you get it right, it is an effective mode of delivering information. And I think, you know, we have a certain amount of, you know, prejudices about how it's supposed to work at people our age. But I think this emerging generation doesn't. Now, it suggests there are some possible vulnerabilities. The propaganda machine loves people who, you know, don't have a lot of categories, you know, who can be moved from one brand to the next. You know, that's what the media loves. That's what the corporate media loves. But I also think there's a certain smarts there. You can't watch Colbert on a couch, you know, with like six beers and expect to get anything out of it. You got to be sophisticated.
Well, John, thank you for your insightful views on the world of media, on the world in general, and your
own. And sex. Yeah,
oh, yeah. And in right. Sex. Yeah.
Listen to her.
I love that we can talk about sex. I love that I can talk about sex with you. You can find out more about John Hockenberry at thetakeaway.org. I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference. We can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Design Matters with Debbie Millman is recorded at the Masters in Branding Studio at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. It is produced by Curtis Fox Productions with technical assistance by Rainey Ortica and research by Jen Simon. The show is published exclusively by DesignObserver.com. You can subscribe to this free podcast in the iTunes Store.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.